definition will no longer be part of the surviving gambler's community. This explains beginner's luck. There is an analogy with what is called in common parlance a swimmer's body, which led to a mistake I shamefully made a few years ago. In spite of my specialty in this bias, I did not notice that I was being fooled. When asking around about the comparative physical elegance of athletes, I was often told that runners looked anorexic, cyclists bottom-heavy, and weightlifters insecure and a little primitive. I inferred that I should spend some time inhaling chlorine in the New York University pool to get those elongated muscles. Now suspend the causality. Assume that a person's genetic variance allows for a certain type of body shape. Those born with a natural tendency to develop a swimmer's body become better swimmers. These are the ones you see in your sample splashing up and down at the pools. But they would have looked pretty much the same if they lifted weights. It is a fact that a given muscle grows almost the same way whether you take steroids or climb walls at the local gym. What you see and what you don't see. Katrina, the devastating hurricane that hit New Orleans in 2005, got plenty of politicizing politicians on television. These legislators, moved by the images of devastation and the pictures of angry victims made homeless, made promises of rebuilding. It was so noble on their part to do something humanitarian, to rise above our abject selfishness. Did they promise to do so with their own money? No. It was with public money. Consider that such funds will be taken away from somewhere else, as in the saying, "You take from Peter to give to Paul." That somewhere else will be less mediatized. It may be privately funded cancer research, or the next efforts to curb diabetes. Few seem to pay attention to the victims of cancer lying lonely in a state of untelevised depression. Not only do these cancer patients not vote, they will be dead by the next ballot, but they do not manifest themselves to our emotional system. More of them die every day than were killed by Hurricane Katrina. They are the ones who need us the most, not just our financial help, but our attention and kindness. And they may be the ones from whom the money will be taken. Indirectly, perhaps even directly. Money, public or private, taken away from research might be responsible for killing them, in a crime that may remain silent. A ramification of the idea concerns our decision-making under a cloud of possibilities. We see the obvious invisible consequences, not the invisible and less obvious ones. Yet those unseen consequences can be, nay, generally are, more meaningful. Frédéric Bastiat was a 19th-century humanist of a strange variety, one of those rare independent thinkers, independent to the point of being unknown in his own country, France, since his ideas ran counter to French political orthodoxy. He joins another of my favorite thinkers, Pierre Bell, in being unknown at home and in his own language. But he has a large number of followers in America. In his essay, What We See and What We Don't See, Bastiat offered the following idea. We can see what governments do, and therefore sing their praises, but we do not see the alternative. But there is an alternative. It is less obvious and remains unseen. Recall the confirmation fallacy. Governments are great at telling you what they did, but not what they did not do. In fact, they engage in what could be labeled as phony philanthropy. The activity of helping people in a visible and sensational way without taking into account the unseen cemetery of invisible consequences. Bastiat inspired libertarians by attacking the usual arguments that showed the benefits of governments, but his ideas can be generalized to apply to both the right and the left. Bastiat goes a bit deeper. If both the positive and the negative consequences of an action fell on its author, our learning would be fast. But often an action's positive consequences benefit only its author, since they are visible, while the negative consequences, being invisible, apply to others, with a net cost to society. Consider job protection measures. You notice those whose jobs are made safe and ascribe social benefits to such protections. You do not notice the effect on those who cannot find a job as a result, since the measure will reduce job openings. In some cases, as with the cancer patients who may be punished by Katrina, the positive consequences of an action will immediately benefit the politicians and phony humanitarians, While the negative ones take a long time to appear, they may never become noticeable. One can even blame the press for directing charitable contributions toward those who may need them the least. Let us apply this reasoning to September 11, 2001. Around 2,500 people were directly killed by bin Laden's group in the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. Their families benefited from the support of all manner of agencies and charities, as they should. But, according to researchers, during the remaining 3 months of the year, close to 1,000 people died as silent victims of the terrorists. How? Those who were afraid of flying and switched to driving ran an increased risk of death. There was evidence of an increase in casualties on the road during that period. The road is considerably more lethal than the skies. These families got no support. They did not even know that their loved ones were also the victims of bin Laden. In addition to Bastiat, I have a weakness for Ralph Nader, the activist and consumer advocate, certainly not the politician and political thinker. He may be the American citizen who saved the highest number of lives by exposing the safety record of car companies. But in his political campaign a few years ago, even he forgot to trumpet the tens of thousands of lives saved by his seatbelt laws. It is much easier to sell, "Look what I did for you," than "Look what I avoided for you." Recall from the prologue the story of the hypothetical legislator whose actions might have avoided the attack of September 11. How many such people are walking the street without the upright gait of the phony hero? Have the guts to consider the silent consequences when standing in front of the next snake oil humanitarian. Doctors. Our neglect of silent evidence kills people daily. Assume that a drug saves many people from a potentially dangerous ailment, but runs the risk of killing a few, with a net benefit to society. Would a doctor prescribe it? He has no incentive to do so. The lawyers of the person hurt by the side effects will go after the doctor like attack dogs, while the lives saved by the drug might not be accounted for anywhere. A life saved is a statistic. A person hurt is an anecdote. Statistics are invisible. Anecdotes are salient. Likewise, the risk of a black swan is invisible. Footnote. Silent evidence can actually bias matters to look less stable and riskier than they actually are. Take cancer. We are in the habit of counting survival rates from diagnosed cancer cases, which should overestimate the danger from cancer. Many people develop cancer that remains undiagnosed and go on to live a long and comfortable life, then die of something else, either because their cancer was not lethal or because it went into spontaneous remission. Not counting these cases biases the risks upward. The Teflon-style protection of Giacomo Casanova. This brings us to the gravest of all manifestations of silent evidence, the illusion of stability. The bias lowers our perception of the risks we incurred in the past, particularly for those of us who are lucky to have survived them. Your life came under a serious threat, but, having survived it, you retrospectively underestimate how risky the situation actually was. The adventurer Giacomo Casanova, later self-styled Jacques Chevalier de Songault, the wannabe intellectual and legendary seducer of women, seems to have had a Teflon-style trait that would cause envy on the part of the most resilient of mafia dons. Misfortune did not stick to him. Casanova, while known for his seductions, viewed himself as some sort of a scholar. He aimed at literary fame with his 12-volume History of My Life, written in bad, charmingly bad, French. In addition to the extremely useful lessons on how to become a seducer, the history provides an engrossing account of a succession of reversals of fortune. Casanova felt that every time he got into difficulties, his lucky star, his étoile, would pull him out of trouble. After things got bad for him, they somehow recovered by some invisible hand, and he was led to believe that it was his intrinsic property to recover from hardships by running every time into a new opportunity. He would somehow meet someone in extremis who offered him a financial transaction, a new patron that he had not betrayed in the past, or someone generous enough and with a weak enough memory to forget past betrayals. Could Casanova have been selected by destiny to bounce back from all these hardships? Not necessarily. Consider the following. Of all the colorful adventurers who have lived on our planet, many were occasionally crushed, and a few did bounce back repeatedly. It is those who survive who will tend to believe that they are indestructible. They will have a long and interesting enough experience to write books about it, until, of course. Actually, adventurers who feel singled out by destiny abound, simply because there are plenty of adventurers, and we do not hear the stories of those down on their luck. As I started writing this chapter, I recalled a conversation with a woman about her flamboyant fiancé, the son of a civil servant, who managed through a few financial transactions to catapult himself into the life of a character in a novel, with handmade shoes, Cuban cigars, collectible cars, and so on. The French have a word for this, flambeur, which means a mixture of extravagant bon vivant, wild speculator, and risk-taker, all the while bearing considerable personal charm. A word that does not seem to be available in Anglo-Saxon cultures. The fiancé was spending his money very quickly, and as we were having the conversation about his fate, she was going to marry him after all. She explained to me that he was undergoing slightly difficult times, but that there was no need to worry since he always came back with a vengeance. That was a few years ago. Out of curiosity, I have just tracked him down, trying to do so tactfully. He has not recovered yet from his latest blow of fortune. He also dropped out of the scene and is no longer to be found among other flambeurs. How does this relate to the dynamics of history? Consider what is generally called the resilience of New York City. For seemingly transcendental reasons, every time it gets close to the brink of disaster, the city manages to pull back and recover. Some people truly believe that this is an internal property of New York City. The following quote is from a New York Times article. Which is why New York still needs Samuel M. E., an economist who turns 77 today. Mr. E. studied New York City through half a century of booms and busts. We have a record of going through tough times and coming back stronger than ever, he said. Now run the idea in reverse. Think of cities as little Giacomo Casanovas, or as rats in my laboratory. As we put the thousands of rats through a very dangerous process, let's put a collection of cities in a simulator of history. Rome, Athens, Carthage, Byzantium, Tyre, Çatalhöyük, located in modern-day Turkey. It is one of the first known human settlements. Jericho, Peoria, and of course, New York City. Some cities will survive the harsh conditions of the simulator. As to others, we know that history might not be too kind. I am sure that Carthage, Tyre, and Jericho had their local, no less eloquent, Samuel M.E. saying, "Our enemies have tried to destroy us many times, but we always come back more resilient than before. We are now invincible." This bias causes the survivor to be an unqualified witness of the process. Unsettling? The fact that you survived is a condition that may weaken your interpretation of the properties of the survival, including the shallow notion of cause. You can do a lot with the above statement. Replace the retired economist Samuel E. with a CEO discussing his corporation's ability to recover from past problems. How about the touted resilience of the financial system? How about a general who has had a good run? The reader can now see why I use Casanova's unfailing luck as a generalized framework for the analysis of history, all histories. I generate artificial histories featuring, say, millions of Giacomo Casanovas and observe the difference between the attributes of the successful Casanovas, because you generate them, you know their exact properties, and those an observer of the result would obtain. From that perspective, it is not a good idea to be a Casanova. I am a risk-taker. Consider the restaurant business in a competitive place like New York City. One has indeed to be foolish to open one, owing to the enormous risks involved and the harrying quantity of work to get anywhere in the business, not counting the finicky fashion-minded clients. The cemetery of failed restaurants is very silent. Walk around Midtown Manhattan and you will see these warm, patron-filled restaurants with limos waiting outside for the diners to come out with their second trophy spouses. The owner is overworked but happy to have all these important people patronize his eatery. Does this mean that it makes sense to open a restaurant in such a competitive neighborhood? Certainly not. Yet people do it out of the foolish risk-taking trait that pushes us to jump into such adventures, blinded by the outcome. Clearly, there is an element of the surviving Casanova in us, that of the risk-taking genes, which encourages us to take blind risks, unaware of the variability in the possible outcomes. We inherited the taste for uncalculated risk-taking. Should we encourage such behavior? In fact, economic growth comes from such risk-taking. But some fool might argue the following. If someone followed reasoning such as mine, we would not have had the spectacular growth we experienced in the past. This is exactly like someone playing Russian roulette and finding it a good idea because he survived and pocketed the money. We are often told that we humans have an optimistic bent and that it is supposed to be good for us. This argument appears to justify general risk-taking as a positive enterprise and one that is glorified in the common culture. Hey, look, our ancestors took the challenges, while you, NNT, are encouraging us to do nothing. I am not. We have enough evidence to confirm that, indeed, we humans are an extremely lucky species, and that we got the genes of the risk-takers. The foolish risk-takers, that is. In fact, the Casanovas who survived. Once again, I am not dismissing the idea of risk-taking, having been involved in it myself. I am only critical of the encouragement of uninformed risk-taking. The uber-psychologist Danny Kahneman has given us evidence that we generally take risks not out of bravado, but out of ignorance and blindness to probability. The next few chapters will show in more depth how we tend to dismiss outliers and adverse outcomes when projecting the future. But I insist on the following: that we got here by accident does not mean that we should continue to take the same risks. We are mature enough a race to realize this point, enjoy our blessings, and try to preserve, by becoming more conservative, what we got by luck. We have been playing Russian roulette. Now let's stop and get a real job. I have two further points to make on this subject. First, justification of over-optimism on grounds that it brought us here arises from a far more serious mistake about human nature. The belief that we are built to understand nature and our own nature, and that our decisions are, and have been, the result of our own choices. I beg to disagree. So many instincts drive us. Second, a little more worrisome than the first point, evolutionary fitness is something that is continuously touted and aggrandized by the crowd who takes it as gospel. The more unfamiliar someone is with the wild black swan-generating randomness, the more he or she believes in the optimal working of evolution. Silent evidence is not present in their theories. Evolution is a series of flukes, some good, many bad. You only see the good. But in the short term, it is not obvious which traits are really good for you, particularly if you are in the black swan-generating environment of extremistan. This is like looking at rich gamblers coming out of the casino and claiming that a taste for gambling is good for the species because gambling makes you rich. Risk-taking made many species head for extinction. This idea that we are here, that this is the best of all possible worlds, and that evolution did a great job, seems rather bogus in the light of the silent evidence effect. The fools, the Casanovas, and the blind risk-takers are often the ones who win in the short term. Worse, in a black swan environment, where one single but rare event can come shake up a species after a very long run of fitness, the foolish risk-takers can also win in the long term. I will revisit this idea in Part 3, where I show how extremistan worsens the silent evidence effect. But there is another manifestation that merits a mention. I am a black swan. The anthropic bias. I want to stay closer to Earth and avoid bringing higher-up metaphysical or cosmological arguments into this discussion. There are so many significant dangers to worry about down here on planet Earth, and it would be a good idea to postpone the metaphysical philosophizing for later. But it would be useful to take a peek, not more, at what is called the anthropic cosmological argument, as it points out the gravity of our misunderstanding of historical stability. A recent wave of philosophers and physicists, and people combining the two categories, has been examining the self-sampling assumption, which is a generalization of the principle of the Casanova bias to our own existence. consider our own fates. Some people reason that the odds of any of us being in existence are so low that our being here cannot be attributed to an accident of fate. Think of the odds of the parameters being exactly where they need to be to induce our existence. Any deviation from the optimal calibration would have made our world explode, collapse, or simply not come into existence. It is often said that the world seems to have been built to the specifications that would make our existence possible. According to such an argument, it could not come from luck. However, our presence in the sample completely vitiates the computation of the odds. Again, the story of Casanova can make the point quite simple, much simpler than in its usual formulation. Think again of all the possible worlds as little Casanovas following their own fates. The one who is still kicking, by accident, will feel that, given that he cannot be so lucky, there had to be some transcendental force guiding him and supervising his destiny. Hey, otherwise the odds would be too low to get here just by luck. For someone who observes all adventurers, the odds of finding a Casanova are not low at all. There are so many adventurers, and someone is bound to win the lottery ticket. The problem here with the universe and the human race is that we are the surviving Casanovas. When you start with many adventurous Casanovas, there is bound to be a survivor. And guess what? If you are here, talking about it, you are likely to be that particular one. Notice the condition. You survived to talk about it. So we can no longer naively compute odds without considering that the condition that we are in existence imposes restrictions on the process that led us here. Assume that history delivers either bleak, i.e. unfavorable, or rosy, i.e. favorable, scenarios. The bleak scenarios lead to extinction. Clearly, if I am now writing these lines, it is certainly because history delivered a rosy scenario, one that allowed me to be here. A historical route in which my forebears avoided massacre by the many invaders who roamed the Levant. Add to that beneficial scenarios free of meteorite collisions, nuclear war, and other large-scale terminal epidemics. But I do not have to look at humanity as a whole. Whenever I probe into my own biography, I am alarmed at how tenuous my life has been so far. Once, when I returned to Lebanon during the war, at the age of 18, I felt episodes of extraordinary fatigue and cold chills, in spite of the summer heat. It was typhoid fever. Had it not been for the discovery of antibiotics only a few decades earlier, I would not be here today. I was also later cured of another severe disease that would have left me for dead, thanks to a treatment that depends on another recent medical technology. As a human being alive here in the age of the Internet, capable of writing and reaching an audience, I have also benefited from society's luck and the remarkable absence of recent large-scale war. In addition, I am the result of the rise of the human race, itself an accidental event. My being here is a consequential low-probability occurrence, and I tend to forget it. Let us return to the touted recipes for becoming a millionaire in 10 steps. A successful person will try to convince you that his achievements could not possibly be accidental, just as a gambler who wins at roulette 7 times in a row will explain to you that the odds against such a streak are 1 in several million. So you either have to believe some transcendental intervention is in play, or accept his skills and insight in picking the winning numbers. But if you take into account the quantity of gamblers out there, and the number of gambling sessions, several million episodes in total, then it becomes obvious that such strokes of luck are bound to happen, and if you are talking about them, they have happened to you. The reference point argument is as follows. Do not compute odds from the vantage point of the winning gambler, or the lucky Casanova, or the endlessly bouncing back New York City, or the invincible Carthage, but from all those who started in the cohort. Consider once again the example of the gambler. If you look at the population of beginning gamblers taken as a whole, you can be close to certain that one of them, but you do not know in advance which one, will show stellar results just by luck. So, from the reference point of the beginning cohort, this is not a big deal. But from the reference point of the winner, and who does not, and this is key, take the losers into account, a long string of wins will appear to be too extraordinary an occurrence to be explained by luck. Note that a history is just a series of numbers through time. The numbers can represent degrees of wealth, fitness, weight, anything. The cosmetic because. This in itself greatly weakens the notion of because that is often propounded by scientists and almost always misused by historians. We have to accept the fuzziness of the familiar because, no matter how queasy it makes us feel, and it does make us queasy to remove the analgesic illusion of causality. I repeat that we are explanation-seeking animals who tend to think that everything has an identifiable cause and grab the most apparent one as the explanation. Yet there may not be a visible because. To the contrary, frequently there is nothing, not even a spectrum of possible explanations. But silent evidence masks this fact. Whenever our survival is in play, the very notion of because is severely weakened. The condition of survival drowns all possible explanations. The Aristotelian because is not there to account for a solid link between two items, but rather, as we saw in Chapter 6, to cater to our hidden weaknesses for imparting explanations. Apply this reasoning to the following question. Why didn't the bubonic plague kill more people? People will supply quantities of cosmetic explanations involving theories about the intensity of the plague and scientific models of epidemics. Now, try the weakened causality argument that I have just emphasized in this chapter. Had the bubonic plague killed more people, the observers, us, would not be here to observe. So it may not necessarily be the property of diseases to spare us humans. Whenever your survival is in play, don't immediately look for causes and effects. The main identifiable reason for our survival of such diseases might simply be inaccessible to us. We are here since Casanova style, the rosy scenario played out. And if it seems too hard to understand, it is because we are too brainwashed by notions of causality, and we think that it is smarter to say because than to accept randomness. My biggest problem with the educational system lies precisely in that it forces students to squeeze explanations out of subject matters and shames them for withholding judgment, for uttering the "I don't know." Why did the Cold War end? Why did the Persians lose the Battle of Salamis? Why did Hannibal get his behind kicked? Why did Casanova bounce back from hardship? In each of these examples, we are taking a condition, survival, and looking for the explanations, instead of flipping the argument on its head and stating that, conditional on such survival, one cannot read that much into the process, and should learn instead to invoke some measure of randomness. Randomness, in practice, is what we don't know. To invoke randomness is to plead ignorance. It is not just your college professor who gives you bad habits. I showed in Chapter 6 how newspapers need to stuff their texts with causal links to make you enjoy the narratives. But have the integrity to deliver your because very sparingly. Try to limit it to situations where the because is derived from experiments, not backward-looking history. Note here that I am not saying causes do not exist. Do not use this argument to avoid trying to learn from history. All I am saying is that it is not so simple. Be suspicious of the because and handle it with care, particularly in situations where you suspect silent evidence. We have seen several varieties of the silent evidence that cause deformations in our perception of empirical reality, making it appear more explainable and more stable than it actually is. In addition to the confirmation error and the narrative fallacy, the manifestations of silent evidence further distort the role and importance of black swans. In fact, they cause a gross overestimation at times, say with literary success, and underestimation at others, the stability of history, the stability of our human species. I said earlier that our perceptual system may not react to what does not lie in front of our eyes, or what does not arouse our emotional attention. We are made to be superficial, to heed what we see and not heed what does not vividly come to mind. We wage a double war against silent evidence. The unconscious part of our inferential mechanism, and there is one, will ignore the cemetery, even if we are intellectually aware of the need to take it into account. out of sight, out of mind. We harbor a natural, even physical, scorn of the abstract. This will be further illustrated in the next chapter. Chapter 9. The Ludic Fallacy, or the Uncertainty of the Nerd. Lunch at Lake Como, West. The military as philosophers. Plato's randomness. Fat Tony. Fat Tony is one of Nero's friends who irritates Yevgenia Krasnova beyond measure. We should perhaps more thoughtfully style him horizontally challenged Tony, since he is not as objectively overweight as his nickname indicates. It is just that his body shape makes whatever he wears seem ill-fitted. He wears only tailored suits, many of them cut for him in Rome, but they look as if he bought them from a web catalog. He has thick hands, hairy fingers, wears a gold wrist chain, and reeks of licorice candies that he devours in industrial quantities as a substitute for an old smoking habit. He doesn't usually mind people calling him Fat Tony, but he much prefers to be called just Tony. Nero calls him, more politely, Brooklyn Tony, because of his accent and his Brooklyn way of thinking, though Tony is one of the prosperous Brooklyn people who moved to New Jersey 20 years ago. Tony is a successful non-nerd with a happy disposition. He leads a gregarious existence. His sole visible problem seems to be his weight and the corresponding nagging by his family, remote cousins, and friends, who keep warning him about that premature heart attack. Nothing seems to work. Tony often goes to a fat farm in Arizona to not eat, lose a few pounds, then gain almost all of them back in his first-class seat on the flight back. It is remarkable how his self-control and personal discipline, otherwise admirable, fail to apply to his waistline. He started as a clerk in the back office of a New York bank in the early 1980s, in the letter of credit department. He pushed papers and did some grunt work. Later, he grew into giving small business loans and figured out the game of how you can get financing from the monster banks, how their bureaucracies operate, and what they like to see on paper. All the while an employee, he started acquiring property in bankruptcy proceedings, buying it from financial institutions. His big insight is that bank employees who sell you a house that's not theirs just don't care as much as the owners. Tony knew very rapidly how to talk to them and maneuver. Later, he also learned to buy and sell gas stations with money borrowed from small neighborhood bankers. Tony has this remarkable habit of trying to make a buck effortlessly, just for entertainment, without straining, without office work, without meeting, just by melding his deals into his private life. Tony's motto is, finding who the sucker is. Obviously, they're often the banks. The clerks don't care about nothing. Finding these suckers is second nature to him. If you took walks around the block with Tony, you would feel considerably more informed about the texture of the world just talking to him. Tony is remarkably gifted at getting unlisted phone numbers, first-class seats on airlines for no additional money, or your car in a garage that is officially full, either through connections or his forceful charm. Non-Brooklyn John. I found the perfect non-Brooklyn in someone I will call Dr. John. He is a former engineer, currently working as an actuary for an insurance company. He is thin, wiry, and wears glasses and a dark suit. He lives in New Jersey, not far from Fat Tony, but certainly they rarely run into each other. Tony never takes the train and, actually, never commutes. He drives a Cadillac, and sometimes his wife's Italian convertible, and jokes that he is more visible than the rest of the car. Dr. John is a master of the schedule. He is as predictable as a clock. He quietly and efficiently reads the newspaper on the train to Manhattan, then neatly folds it for the lunchtime continuation. While Tony makes restaurant owners rich, they beam when they see him coming and exchange noisy hugs with him. John meticulously packs his sandwich every morning, fruit salad in a plastic container. As for his clothing, he also wears a suit that looks like it came from a web catalog, except that it is quite likely that it actually did. Dr. John is a painstaking, reasoned, and gentle fellow. He takes his work seriously, so seriously that, unlike Tony, you can see a line in the sand between his working time and his leisure activities. He has a PhD in electrical engineering from the University of Texas at Austin. Since he knows both computers and statistics, he was hired by an insurance company to do computer simulations. He enjoys the business. Much of what he does consists of running computer programs for risk management. I know that it is rare for Fat Tony and Dr. John to breathe the same air, let alone find themselves at the same bar, so consider this a pure thought exercise. I will ask each of them a question and compare their answers. NNT, that is me. Assume that a coin is fair, i.e., has an equal probability of coming up heads or tails when flipped. I flip it 99 times and get heads each time. What are the odds of my getting tails on my next throw? Dr. John. Trivial question. 1/2, of course, since you are assuming 50% odds for each and independence between draws. NNT. What do you say, Tony? Fat Tony. I'd say no more than 1%, of course. NNT. Why so? I gave you the initial assumption of a fair coin, meaning that it was 50% either way. Fat Tony. You were either full of crap or a pure sucker to buy that 50% business. The coin gotta be loaded. It can't be a fair game. Translation. It is far more likely that your assumptions about the fairness are wrong than the coin delivering 99 heads in 99 throws. NNT. But Dr. John said 50%. Fat Tony, whispering in my ear. I know these guys with the nerd examples from the bank days. They think way too slow, and they are too commoditized. You can take them for a ride. Now, of the two of them, which would you favor for the position of mayor of New York City, or Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia? Dr. John thinks entirely within the box that was given to him. Fat Tony, almost entirely outside the box. To set the terminology straight, what I call a nerd here doesn't have to look sloppy, unaesthetic, and sallow, and wear glasses and a portable computer on his belt as if it were an ostensible weapon. A nerd is simply someone who thinks exceedingly inside the box. Have you ever wondered why so many of these straight-A students end up going nowhere in life, while someone who lagged behind is now getting the shekels, buying the diamonds, and getting his phone calls returned? Or even getting the Nobel Prize in a real discipline, say, medicine. Some of this may have something to do with luck in outcomes, but there is this sterile and obscurantist quality that is often associated with classroom knowledge that may get in the way of understanding what's going on in real life. In an IQ test, as well as in any academic setting, including sports, Dr. John would vastly outperform Fat Tony. But Fat Tony would outperform Dr. John in any other possible ecological, real-life situation. In fact, Tony, in spite of his lack of culture, has an enormous curiosity about the texture of reality and his own erudition. To me, he is more scientific in the literal, though not in the social, sense than Dr. John. We will get deep, very deep, into the difference between the answers of Fat Tony and Dr. John. This is probably the most vexing problem I know about the connections between two varieties of knowledge, what we dub Platonic and aplatonic. Simply, people like Dr. John can cause black swans outside Mediocristan. Their minds are closed. While the problem is very general, one of its nastiest delusions is what I call the ludic fallacy. The attributes of uncertainty we face in real life have little connection to the sterilized ones we encounter in exams and games. So I close part one with the following story. Lunch at Lake Como. One spring day a few years ago, I was surprised to receive an invitation from a think tank sponsored by the United States Defense Department to a brainstorming session on risk that was to take place in Las Vegas the following fall. The person who invited me announced on the phone, "We'll have lunch on a terrace overlooking Lake Como," which put me in a state of severe distress. Las Vegas, along with its sibling, the Emirate of Dubai, is perhaps one place I'd never wish to visit before I die. Lunch at Fake Como would be torture, but I'm glad I went. The think tank had gathered a non-political collection of people they call doers and scholars, and practitioners like me who do not accept the distinction, involved in uncertainty in a variety of disciplines, and they symbolically picked a major casino as a venue. The symposium was a closed-door synod-style assembly of people who would never have mixed otherwise. My first surprise was to discover that the military people there thought, behaved, and acted like philosophers, far more so than the philosophers we will see splitting hairs in their weekly colloquium in Part 3. They thought out of the box, like traders, except much better and without fear of introspection. An Assistant Secretary of Defense was among us, but had I not known his profession, I would have thought he was a practitioner of skeptical empiricism. Even an engineering investigator who had examined the cause of a space shuttle explosion was thoughtful and open-minded. I came out of the meeting realizing that only military people deal with randomness with genuine, introspective, intellectual honesty, unlike academics and corporate executives using other people's money. This does not show in war movies, where they are usually portrayed as war-hungry autocrats. The people in front of me were not the people who initiate wars. Indeed, for many, the successful defense policy is the one that manages to eliminate potential dangers without war, such as the strategy of bankrupting the Russians through the escalation in defense spending. When I expressed my amazement to Lawrence, another finance person who was sitting next to me, he told me that the military collected more genuine intellects and risk thinkers than most, if not all, other professions. Defense people wanted to understand the epistemology of risk. In the group was a gentleman who ran a group of professional gamblers and who was banned from most casinos. He had come to share his wisdom with us. He sat not far from a stuffy professor of political science, dry like a bone and, as is characteristic of big names, careful about his reputation, who said nothing out of the box and who did not smile once. During the sessions, I tried to imagine the hotshot with a rat dropped down his back, putting him in a state of wriggling panic. He was perhaps good at writing platonic models of something called game theory, but when Lawrence and I went after him on his improper use of financial metaphors, he lost all his arrogance. Now, when you think of the major risks casinos face, gambling situations come to mind. In a casino, one would think, the risks include lucky gamblers blowing up the house with a series of large wins and cheaters taking away money through devious methods. It is not just the general public that would believe so, but the casino management as well. Consequently, the casino had a high-tech surveillance system tracking cheaters, card counters, and other people who try to derive an advantage over them. Each of these participants gave his presentation and listened to those of the others. I came to discuss black swans, and I intended to tell them that the only thing I know is that we know precious little about them, but that it was their property to sneak up on us, and that attempts at platonifying them led to additional misunderstandings. Military people can understand such things, and the idea became recently prevalent in military circles with the expression unknown unknown, as opposed to the known unknown. But I had prepared my talk on 5 restaurant napkins, some stained, and was ready to discuss a new phrase I coined for the occasion, the ludic fallacy. I intended to tell them that I should not be speaking at a casino because it had nothing to do with uncertainty. The uncertainty of the nerd. What is the ludic fallacy? Ludic comes from ludus, Latin for games. I was hoping that the representatives of the casino would speak before me so I could start harassing them by showing, politely, that a casino was precisely the venue not to pick for such a discussion, since the class of risks casinos encounter are very insignificant outside of the building, and their study not readily transferable. My idea is that gambling was sterilized and domesticated uncertainty. In the casino, you know the rules, you can calculate the odds, and the type of uncertainty we encounter there, we will see later, is mild, belonging to mediocristan. My prepared statement was this. The casino is the only human venture I know where the probabilities are known, Gaussian, i.e. bell curve, and almost computable. You cannot expect the casino to pay out 1,000,000 times your bet or to change the rules abruptly on you during the game. There are never days in which 36 black is designed to pop up 95% of the time. Footnote. My colleague Mark Spitznagel found a martial version of the ludic fallacy. Organized competitive fighting trains the athlete to focus on the game and, in order not to dissipate his concentration, to ignore the possibility of what is not specifically allowed by the rules, such as kicks to the groin, a surprise knife, etc. So those who win the gold medal might be precisely those who will be most vulnerable in real life. Likewise, you see people with huge muscles in black t-shirts who can impress you in the artificial environment of the gym, but are unable to lift a stone. In real life, you do not know the odds. You need to discover them, and the sources of uncertainty are not defined. Economists, who do not consider what was discovered by non-economists worthwhile, draw an artificial distinction between Knightian risks, which you can compute, and Knightian uncertainty, which you cannot compute. After one Frank Knight, who rediscovered the notion of unknown uncertainty and did a lot of thinking, but perhaps never took risks, or perhaps lived in the vicinity of a casino. Had he taken economic or financial risks, he would have realized that these computable risks are largely absent from real life. They are laboratory contraptions. Yet we automatically, spontaneously associate chance with these platonified games. I find it infuriating to listen to people who, upon being informed that I specialize in problems of chance, immediately shower me with references to dice. Two illustrators for a paperback edition of one of my books spontaneously and independently added a die to the cover and below every chapter, throwing me into a state of rage. The editor, familiar with my thinking, warned them to avoid the ludic fallacy, as if it were a well-known intellectual violation. Amusingly, they both reacted with an, "Ah, sorry, we didn't know." Those who spend too much time with their noses glued to maps will tend to mistake the map for the territory. Go buy a recent history of probability and probabilistic thinking. You will be showered with names of alleged probability thinkers who all base their ideas on these sterilized constructs. I recently looked at what college students are taught under the subject of chance and came out horrified. They were brainwashed with this ludic fallacy and the outlandish bell curve. The same is true of people doing PhDs in the field of probability theory. I'm reminded of a recent book by a thoughtful mathematician, Amir Aksel, called Chance. Excellent book, perhaps, but like all other modern books, it is grounded in the ludic fallacy. Furthermore, assuming chance has anything to do with mathematics, what little mathematization we can do in the real world does not assume the mild randomness represented by the bell curve, but rather scalable, wild randomness. What can be mathematized is usually not Gaussian, but Mandelbrotian. Now, go read any of the classical thinkers who had something practical to say about the subject of chance, such as Cicero, and you find something different, a notion of probability that remains fuzzy throughout, as it needs to be, since such fuzziness is the very nature of uncertainty. Probability is a liberal art. It is a child of skepticism, not a tool for people with calculators on their belts to satisfy their desire to produce fancy calculations and certainties. Before Western thinking drowned in its scientific mentality, what is arrogantly called the Enlightenment, people prompted their brain to think, not compute. In a beautiful treatise now vanished from our consciousness, Dissertation on the Search for Truth, published in 1673, the polemist Simon Fouché exposed our psychological predilection for certainties. He teaches us the art of doubting, how to position ourselves between doubting and believing. He writes, "One needs to exit doubt in order to produce science, but few people heed the importance of not exiting from it prematurely. It is a fact that one usually exits doubt without realizing it." He warns us further, "We are dogma-prone from our mother's wombs." By the confirmation error discussed in Chapter 5, we use the example of games, which probability theory was successful at tracking, and claimed that this is a general case. Furthermore, just as we tend to underestimate the role of luck in life in general, we tend to overestimate it in games of chance. "This building is inside the Platonic fold. Life stands outside of it," I wanted to shout. Gambling with the wrong dice. I was in for quite a surprise when I learned that the building, too, was outside the Platonic fold. The casino's risk management, aside from setting its gambling policies, was geared toward reducing the losses resulting from cheaters. One does not need heavy training in probability theory to understand that the casino was sufficiently diversified across the different tables to not have to worry about taking a hit from an extremely lucky gambler, the diversification argument that leads to the bell curve, as we will see in Chapter 15. All they had to do was control the whales, the high rollers flown in at the casino's expense from Manila or Hong Kong. Whales can swing several $1 million in a gambling bout. Absent cheating, the performance of most individual gamblers would be the equivalent of a drop in the bucket, making the aggregate very stable. I promised not to discuss any of the details of the casino's sophisticated surveillance system. All I am allowed to say is that I felt transported into a James Bond movie. I wondered if the casino was an imitation of the movies or if it was the other way around. Yet, in spite of such sophistication, their risks had nothing to do with what can be anticipated knowing that the business is a casino. For it turned out that the four largest losses incurred or narrowly avoided by the casino fell completely outside their sophisticated models. First, they lost around $100 million when an irreplaceable performer in their main show was maimed by a tiger. The show, Siegfried and Roy, had been a major Las Vegas attraction. The tiger had been reared by the performer and even slept in his bedroom. Until then, nobody suspected that the powerful animal would turn against its master. In scenario analyses, the casino had even conceived of the animal jumping into the crowd, but nobody came near to the idea of insuring against what happened. Second, a disgruntled contractor was hurt during the construction of a hotel annex. He was so offended by the settlement offered him that he made an attempt to dynamite the casino. His plan was to put explosives around the pillars in the basement. The attempt was, of course, thwarted. Otherwise, to use the arguments in Chapter 8, we would not have been there. But I shivered at the thought of possibly sitting above a pile of dynamite. Third, casinos must file a special form with the Internal Revenue Service, documenting a gambler's profit if it exceeds a given amount. The employee who was supposed to mail the forms hid them instead, for completely unexplainable reasons, in boxes under his desk. This went on for years without anyone noticing that something was wrong. The employees refraining from sending the documents was truly impossible to predict. Tax violations and negligence being serious offenses, the casino faced the near loss of a gambling license or the onerous financial costs of a suspension. Clearly, they ended up paying a monstrous fine, an undisclosed amount, which was the luckiest way out of the problem. Fourth, there was a spate of other dangerous scenes, such as the kidnapping of the casino owner's daughter, which caused him, in order to secure cash for the ransom, to violate gambling laws by dipping into the casino coffers. Conclusion. A back-of-the-envelope calculation shows that the dollar value of these black swans, the off-model hits and potential hits I've just outlined, swamp the on-model risks by a factor of close to 1,000 to 1. The casino spent hundreds of millions of dollars on gambling theory and high-tech surveillance, while the bulk of their risks came from outside their models. All this, and yet the rest of the world still learns about uncertainty and probability from gambling examples. Wrapping up Part 1. The cosmetic rises to the surface. All of the topics in Part 1 are actually only one. You can think about a subject for a long time, to the point of being possessed by it. Somehow you have a lot of ideas, but they do not seem explicitly connected. The logic linking them remains concealed from you. Yet you know deep down that all these are the same idea. Meanwhile, what Nietzsche calls Bildungsphilisters, or learned Philistines, blue collars of the thinking business, tell you that you are spread out between fields. You reply that these disciplines are artificial and arbitrary, to no avail. Footnote. What Nietzsche means by this term are the dogma-prone newspaper readers and opera lovers who have cosmetic exposure to culture and shallow depth. I extend the term here to the Philistine hiding in academia who lacks in erudition out of lack of curiosity and is closely centered on his ideas. Then you tell them that you are a limousine driver, and they leave you alone. You feel better because you do not identify with them, and thus you no longer need to be amputated to fit into the Procrustean bed of the disciplines. Finally, a little push, and you see that it was all one single problem. One evening I found myself at a cocktail party in Munich, at the apartment of a former art historian who had more art books in its library than I thought existed. I stood drinking excellent Riesling in the spontaneously formed English-speaking corner of the apartment, in the hope of getting to a state where I would be able to start speaking my brand of fake German. One of the most insightful thinkers I know, the computer entrepreneur Yossi Vardi, prompted me to summarize my idea while standing on one leg. It was not too convenient to stand on one leg after a few glasses of perfumed Riesling, so I failed in my improvisation. The next day, I experienced staircase wit. I jumped out of bed with the following idea. The cosmetic and the platonic rise naturally to the surface. This is a simple extension of the problem of knowledge. It is simply that one side of Echo's library, the one we never see, has the property of being ignored. This is also the problem of silent evidence. It is why we do not see black swans. We worry about those that happened, not those that may happen but did not. It is why we platonify, liking known schemas and well-organized knowledge, to the point of blindness to reality. It is why we fall for the problem of induction, why we confirm. It is why those who study and fare well in school have a tendency to be suckers for the ludic fallacy. And it is why we have black swans and never learn from their occurrence, because the ones that did not happen were too abstract. Thanks to Vardi, I now belonged to the club of single-idea people. We love the tangible, the confirmation, the palpable, the real, the visible, the concrete, the known, the seen, the vivid, the visual, the social, the embedded, the emotionally laden, the salient, the stereotypical, the moving, the theatrical, the romanced, the cosmetic, the official, the scholarly-sounding verbiage, BS, the pompous Gaussian economist, the mathematicized crap, the pomp, the Académie Française, Harvard Business School, the Nobel Prize, dark business suits with white shirts and Ferragamo ties, the moving discourse, and the lurid. Most of all, we favor the narrated. Alas, we are not manufactured in our current edition of the human race to understand abstract matters. We need context. Randomness and uncertainty are abstractions. We respect what has happened, ignoring what could have happened. In other words, we are naturally shallow and superficial, and we do not know it. This is not a psychological problem. It comes from the main property of information. The dark side of the moon is harder to see. Beaming light on it costs energy. In the same way, beaming light on the unseen is costly in both computational and mental effort. Distance from primates. There have been in history many distinctions between higher and lower forms of humans. For the Greeks, there were the Greeks and the barbarians, those people of the north who uttered amorphous sentences similar to the Attic ear to an animal's shrieks. For the English, a higher form of life was the gentleman's. Contrary to today's definition, a gentleman's life was practiced through idleness and a code of behavior that included, along with a set of manners, the avoidance of work beyond the necessities of comfortable subsistence. For New Yorkers, there are those with a Manhattan zip code and those with such a thing as a Brooklyn, or worse, Queens address. For the earlier Nietzsche, there was the Apollonian compared to the Dionysian. For the better-known Nietzsche, there was the Übermensch, something his readers interpret however it suits them. For a modern Stoic, a higher individual subscribes to a dignified system of virtue that determines elegance in one's behavior and the ability to separate results from efforts. All of these distinctions aim at lengthening the distance between us and our relatives among other primates. I keep insisting that, when it comes to decision-making, the distance between us and these hairy cousins is far shorter than we think. I propose that if you want a simple step to a higher form of life, as distant from the animal as you can get, then you may have to denarrate, that is, shut down the television set, minimize time spent reading newspapers, ignore the blogs, train your reasoning abilities to control your decisions, nudge System 1, the heuristic or experiential system, out of the important ones. Train yourself to spot the difference between the sensational and the empirical. This insulation from the toxicity of the world will have an additional benefit. It will improve your well-being. Also, bear in mind how shallow we are with probability, the mother of all abstract notions. You do not have to do much more in order to gain a deeper understanding of things around you. Above all, learn to avoid tunneling. A bridge here to what is to come. The platonic blindness I illustrated with the casino story has another manifestation, focusing. To be able to focus is a great virtue if you're a watch repairman, a brain surgeon, or a chess player, but the last thing you need to do when you deal with uncertainty is to focus. You should tell uncertainty to focus, not us. This focus makes you a sucker. It translates into prediction problems, as we will see in the next section. Prediction, not narration, is the real test of our understanding of the world. Part 2. We just can't predict. When I ask people to name three recently implemented technologies that most impact our world today, they usually propose the computer, the internet, and the laser. All three were unplanned, unpredicted, and unappreciated upon their discovery, and remained unappreciated well after their initial use. They were consequential. They were black swans. Of course, we have this retrospective illusion of their partaking in some master plan. You can create your own lists with similar results, whether you use political events, wars, or intellectual epidemics. You would expect our record of prediction to be horrible. The world is far, far more complicated than we think, which is not a problem, except when most of us don't know it. We tend to tunnel while looking into the future, making it business as usual, black swan free, when in fact there is nothing usual about the future. It is not a platonic category. We have seen how good we are at narrating backward, at inventing stories that convince us that we understand the past. For many people, knowledge has the remarkable power of producing confidence instead of measurable aptitude. Another problem, the focus on the inconsequential regular, the platonification that makes the forecasting inside the box. I find it scandalous that in spite of the empirical record, we continue to project into the future as if we were good at it, using tools and methods that exclude rare events. Prediction is firmly institutionalized in our world. We are suckers for those who help us navigate uncertainty. Whether the fortune teller or the well-published dull academics or civil servants using phony mathematics. From Yogi Berra to Henri Poincaré. The great baseball coach Yogi Berra has a saying, "It is tough to make predictions, especially about the future." While he did not produce the writings that would allow him to be considered a philosopher, in spite of his wisdom and intellectual abilities, Berra can claim to know something about randomness. He was a practitioner of uncertainty, and as a baseball player and coach, regularly faced random outcomes and had to face their results.